Good morning, everyone. I'm going to open up the Judiciary Committee for Thursday, April 7th. What we're going to do is we're going to take a couple of different matters. I have two councils here, so I've got one that was a carryover, which was Senate Bill 425 for work session. We will be taking care of that. Anyone here on Senate Bill 616, we will not be hearing that today for two reasons. Number one, one of the members, Senator Wissett, wants to speak to the proponents of the bill regarding the dash threes versus the dash twos. So you need to make contact with his office and set up an appointment to meet with him before we take action on that bill. If you're here on Senate Bill 867, we're not going to proceed on that today. And so you do not need to stay around since that one will not be going forward today. And the other stuff, let me just kind of go over a couple other things just to make sure people know where we're at. Everyone's staying here. I don't know why. All right, with that, what we're going to do is we're going to start off with this carryover Senate Bill 425. Bill?
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 425 removes the requirement that the state prove that a person charged with compelling a minor to engage in prostitution knew the person being compelled was a minor, eliminates the defendant did not know the minor's age. Aids or facilitates the crime of compelling prostitution, subject to juvenile 15, 16 to 17 year old to juvenile court jurisdiction as it relates to aids facilitate rather than the 70 month sentences that otherwise would be imposed. That'd be a mandatory minimum. Mr. Chairman of the committee, yesterday you adopted the dash four amendments. All I think left to do was move or not move the bill.
All right, we had some questions yesterday when the bill was before us. Hopefully everyone has had an opportunity to review that. So the chair would entertain a motion as the bill has amended with the dash fours.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 425 as amended by the dash four amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 425 as amended with the dash fours to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. The chair will carry 425 to the floor. We'll close the work session with 425. Now what I have are a number of members that are here today that are going to be giving testimony at the public hearings. I know they have busy schedules. I see Senator Edwards. I think Representative Schaffler is supposed to be here. I don't know if he's here yet. Looks like Senator Edwards, you're going to get to come up first. So I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing for the purpose of getting this testimony on Senate Bill 557. And Council, if you go ahead and give us the overview, since it's the number one bill, we'll go ahead and start off with it.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 557 requires the district attorney of each county to organize a sexual assault response team, requires each team to adopt protocols addressing sexual assault response, requires certain health care facilities to adopt policies for treatment of acute sexual assault patients, requires certain health care facilities that perform forensic medical examinations of sexual assault patients to adopt guidelines developed by the Sexual Assault Task Force, and to employ or contract with sexual assault forensics examiners trained to satisfy certification requirements of the Oregon Sex Assault Examiner, Sex Assault Nurse Examiner Certification Commission declares an emergency effective July 1st.
All right, so I've asked Sarah Hoyt, Senator Edwards' assistant, to come forward as well. I have room for another person. Is there another person you want part of your panel, or just
Whatever pleases the chair. I thought I would just introduce how we got here, and then Sarah and Christine Herman from the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force would perhaps come up next and go over the details and the background, but okay. They could join me and we could do it all now.
And I'm not sure your schedule, if you wanted to stay during this full panel. If not, we'll pose questions.
That is why I proposed that way, because
Let's go ahead and take Senator Edwards' testimony, okay. And then we'll come back and fill the panel and we'll start off from there.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chris Edwards. I'm the state senator in North Eugene, West Eugene, and Junction City. And we bring to you today Senate Bill 557. 557 would require that every county in the state have a sexual assault response team. A sexual assault response team essentially is a victim-centered, law enforcement-based multidisciplinary team to improve the coordination and response and rates of prosecution of sexual assault cases. What we do know is that counties that have well-functioning sexual assault response teams do have better victim better coordination of victim services and higher rates of prosecution. I did want to make clear that this is that this the sexual assault response teams would sit in the DA's office, not actually in the county. So while it is a requirement that every county have one, it's it is not a requirement of the county itself per se. Before I turn it over to my legislative aide Sarah Hoyt to go through all the details of the bill, I just wanted to say, give a brief comment about why I think this is important. I come at this from the perspective not of an advocate or an activist, but just as, a son and a husband and a father. I have a mom, I have a wife, and I have a daughter. And I think that we've come a long ways in how we deal with these kinds of issues, but I think that we have a long way to go. And I know that I want a better society, a more fair society, and a society that takes more seriously sexual assault cases for my daughter Anna, who's only two now, to grow up in. So with that, I did want to also express special thanks to the support of the Oregon Women's and Health Alliance and their support for the bill, and other folks that have worked very actively in development of the bill, specifically the Oregon Hospitals Association, the Oregon Nurses Association, and the DAs, and the chiefs of police and the sheriffs. So with that, I'll turn it over to the brains of the operation.
All right, before you take off, is there any question for Senator Edwards? Not seeing any. Chris, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I want to go ahead and ask Liz Jacobson to please join the panel, and then, Sarah, if you'll start us off.
Yes, thank you, Sarah Brzezinski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Hoyt. I am the legislative policy aide to Senator Chris Edwards. I apologize. I've been sick this week, so if my voice starts giving out, please forgive me. I'm going to keep my remarks brief because I know you have a very packed agenda today, but I wanted to go ahead and give you an overview of the bill that's in front of you. Senate Bill 557 is basically broken into two separate sections. The first section of the bill relates to the actual formation of the sexual assault response teams within the DA's office and lists out a number of key players who nationwide are thought to be members that are key players to the functionality of an actual SART. So we're asking that the district attorney, through their office, organize a SART team that has a member of the district attorney's staff on it, a member of a prosecution-based VAP, which is a victim assistance program, a forensic medical examiner, a representative of local law enforcement or the county sheriff's office, a representative of the local nonprofit, and then anybody else that the DAs think would be advantageous to their county to have on that SART. We also established some guidelines for them to go ahead and adhere by, but we also understand that every county is different, and the last thing we want to go ahead and do is bind the hands of any county to go ahead and implement policy that might be effective for their county that might not work for another. So all we're saying in here is that they have to go ahead and by 2012 have protocols for the formation of their SART established, and they have to meet quarterly. In the Dash 2 amendments that you'll see, we've also proposed that they can adopt in part or in whole protocols that have already been outlaid by the county's child abuse MDT in response to child abuse and child sexual assault. Section 2 of the bill deals with the acute medical response that a victim will receive when they show up to a medical facility as defined in this bill. We're saying that each hospital, emergency service care provider, intermediate care facility, skilled nursing facility, long-term care facility, or residential care facility in the state shall do one of the following. If their facility does not provide forensic medical examinations, they have to at least have transfer protocols in place for getting that victim from their facility to a facility that can do the examination. If they do provide forensic medical examinations, we're saying that depending on the size of the county in which that facility is located, by the end of 2012 or 2013, they need to employ or contract with at least one sexual assault nurse examiner, and that sexual assault nurse examiner only has to be trained, not certified, and they also have to, at minimum, have adopted the Attorney General's guideline for sexual assault medical examinations. There is also in this Dash 2 amendments to this bill allowing for facilities that only provide pediatric medical examinations examinations to go ahead and be exempt from the Attorney General's guidelines. What we have found is in that particular instance, CARES Northwest is a great example up in Portland at Emanuel Hospital. Their guidelines far exceed what is recommended by the Attorney General that they have to have in place. And so we wanted to make sure that this bill in no way, shape, or form impacted an organization like CARES Northwest to be able to continue performing the pediatric medical examinations that they do. The bill does declare an emergency upon passage, and the reason we have that in there is because we wanted to make sure we gave counties and medical facilities ample time to develop their protocols, find nurses that are already employed with their hospital who want to go through the training, or if they don't already have nurses on board who want to become SANE trained, to find somebody who's in their area that could become contracted with that hospital.
All right. Thank you very much. And Christine, you'll go next.
Thank you, Senator Brzozinski and members of the committee. My name is Christine Herman. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Sexual Assault Task Force. And I want to thank Senator Edwards and Sarah Hoyt in his office for doing so much work on this bill and for bringing forward this really important legislation. A sexual assault response team is the best practice for sexual assault response in communities, and that has been recognized nationwide. In front of you, you have several pieces of written testimony, including mine, which outlines some of the studies that I am referring to. You also have testimony from the Marion County District Attorney's Office, the Victim Assistance Program Director, Kim Larson, the Jackson County SART, Haven from Domestic Violence, which serves Wasco, Sherman, Gilliam, and Wheeler counties, Partnership for Safety and Justice, Mackenzie Byram, who is a SANE nurse in Multnomah County, also sits as the co-chair of the Multnomah County SART and the co-chair of the Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force Medical Forensic Committee, which developed the guidelines that Ms. Hoyt just referred to. Also, you have written testimony from the Oregon Law Center in support of this bill. SARTs provide communities with a community-specific standard response to sexual assault. And as has been mentioned, communities with SARTs have greater participation from victims in the community, in the criminal justice system. Cases are more likely to proceed to prosecution, and particularly with the evidence collected from sexual assault nurse examiners are more likely to end in conviction, which is significant because what we know is that very few sexual assaults are reported. Very few of the reported sexual assaults end up in prosecution, and even fewer end up in incarceration, which means that when you come right down to it, most sexual assaults are not punished. That is not because people don't care. It's just a number of issues that tend to converge, and the SART can help to identify and address those issues in each community. One example of the effectiveness of a SART is right here in Oregon. Jackson County incorporated their SART. They have it's a 501c3. It's the only 501c3 SART in the state, and they're incredibly active in Jackson County. One of the things that they've found is during the time that they've been incorporated as a SART, their cases of reports of sexual assault to law enforcement have gone from approximately 5% to about 90%, which is astounding. And it's a direct result of the coordinated response and the support given to victims to be able to follow through. The sexual assault nurse examiner is a particularly important piece of the SART. A sexual assault nurse examiner is someone who has obtained at least an RN and who has gotten additional special training for the forensic evidence collection and the treatment of the sexual assault patient. Right now, we have 105 certified SANEs in Oregon. That's not very many certified SANEs for the entire state. We recognize that becoming certified is an additional burden on top of being trained. Certainly, we'd like to see every sexual assault patient treated by a certified SANE. Our second best option would be a trained but not yet certified SANE. And so that's what we've come to you with in this legislation. It's a lot easier to get trained than certified, so we're hoping that we can at least get patients to the trained SANEs until they can become certified. Especially direct your attention to Mackenzie Byram's letter. It's headed to whom it may concern. She, I think, does a really fine job of outlining the importance of a SART and exactly what a SART does. It's not just people getting together for a meeting. They have actual accomplishments and efforts that they're able to point to when they're working well together. The most important, from our standpoint, point of a SART is the fact that it is centered on the needs of the victim and couple that with the needs of the criminal justice system. And for those reasons, we strongly support Senate Bill 557 and encourage you to adopt the Dash 2 amendments and pass those. I do want to apologize. It appears that Liz Jacobson is not here.
She is here.
Oh, she's here.
I'm going to put her on the next panel.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Any questions, Senator Dingfelder?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, ladies, for your testimony. I have a question regarding, and we have a lot of material in front of us, and obviously I'll be reading through this, and as you know, I'm a co-sponsor on the bill.
Right.
However, I do have a question. In your notes, you had mentioned that 25 of the 36 counties in Oregon already have a SART. So the question I have for you is this going to promote consistency among the different counties? Because I'm assuming there's different members right now. And do you have any sense as to the makeup of those SARTs in those counties? Are we going to see major changes, or are they pretty much this is consistent with what we're seeing across the state? And then obviously there are some counties that haven't done it. And the question I have is, you know, are they going to have the resources to do it? So sort of a two-part question.
Chair Brzozinski, Senator Dingfelder, thank you for your question. I actually do have, and I failed to print enough copies this morning, so I'd be happy to bring them back to the committee, a diagram that shows all of the counties and what level their SARTs are currently functioning at and who sits on those. What we have seen is in the 25 counties that have a SART, all of them are in somewhat of a different level of formation, but all the counties that currently have some form of sexual assault response team do have the members on it that we've listed in this bill, and we have run this bill past several already established well-functioning SARTs, and they have said that they feel very confident that this legislation won't affect their ability to continue functioning those levels. One of the reasons why we fully support this and why we like the way that it's been crafted is that it will provide that uniformity so that if you are a sexual assault victim in one county, you can expect the same type of response in another county. So that way, you know, if you're from Multnomah County and your sexual assault is up there, you can expect the same type of community-based response down a smaller county or in something outside of the larger metropolitan area.
And if I may follow up, the second part of my question was just about for the counties, I guess there's only a handful of counties that don't have this. Are they going to have the resources to form those SARTs, and assuming that those resources are available in that county?
Yes, Chair Brzozinski, Senator Dingfelder, we have spoken with several SARTs, and they have said that they will make their protocols that they've already adopted available to those counties to review. We have enough counties here in Oregon that have some type of protocols already developed and across the nation that will be able to find protocols that have already been established that are from a like geographic area, because we understand protocols that might work in one county might not work in another because of various degrees of different makeup for that county. And then the Sexual Assault Task Force will also play a resource in their role as a nonprofit to provide that support mechanism to the SARTs while they're going through their initial formation.
Okay, thank you.
All right, any other questions? Ladies, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next panel is going to be Liz Jacobson, Patricia Moore, and Gretchen Bennett. Please come forward. Oh, Patrick, excuse me.
That's okay.
I apologize. Now I'm reading it again. I had my glasses on. So, whoever would like to get started, if you give us your name, and then we'll take your testimony.
Well, mine is brief, I guess. I'll just jump in and out real quick, if it's all right. Chair Prozanski and Co-Chair Senator Cruz and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gretchen Bennett and I serve as the Executive Director at Liberty House, the Child Abuse Assessment Center akin to CARES Northwest that Sarah kindly referenced, and I appreciated her comments. Just wanted to offer a quick, friendly clarification. We wanted to double-check the clarity, and I have a written piece here. The Dash 2 amendments in line 19 clarifies the exemption for services like CARES Northwest, and we were clarifying that perhaps an additional word after the word hospital to read or child abuse assessment center just might help clarify that, because there's organizations such as Liberty House that operate as separate clinics, not part of hospitals. So we hope that's a simple, friendly amendment, and I don't know if it's at this point more helpful to express willingness to work on that on the House side, given the process, and I appreciate Sarah's clarity in the comments as well.
All right. Stay, please don't leave. All right, who would like to go next? Patrick?
Yes. Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Cruz, and committee members, my name is Patrick Moore, M-O-O-R-E, and I'm a lieutenant with the Roseburg Police Department in Douglas County. And in speaking in support of Senate Bill 557, I'd like to give a quick success story from rural and southern Oregon as to the enhancements of that a SART made on a community. When we first began a SART in about 2002, there was, of course, a honeymoon period. As administrations changed over, there was later on some resistance and eventually some acceptance, and once again, every member of that county embraced the SART. What occurred in speaking in both sections and one and two of the bill, one thing that I think both sections have in common are that they require policies to be developed and followed, which of course is a cost-free measure in any county. It just takes those agencies getting together, developing that policy, and then following them. Consistency, and speaking of two of the professions mentioned on the SART, law enforcement and emergency medical, such as hospitals, of course, one of the things they have in common are that most of those members are, you know, the proverbial jacks of all trades, masters of very few. Sexual assault is not an area in which a lot of emergency room providers or police officers, for that matter, specialize in. When we have policies in which can be followed, of course, consistency goes up in addition to the number of reports going up once we are, so to speak, open for business. The number of professions that are listed in Section 1 of the bill are professions that didn't always work well together, maybe a little bit better than this would provide. But the SART concept, getting those, as it requires meetings quarterly, most SARTs actually do meet more often than that, meetings quarterly, gets all those differing professions in the room together to develop those policies, discuss cases, what's gone well recently and what hasn't. And back to Section 2 of the bill, specific to the medical providers. A little bit more of a cost there, but I've been involved in providing the training to nurses, and it's actually fairly doable. It's provided regionally, periodically, and, you know, the instruction is not very costly. We've in my hospital in Douglas County, we've sent six or seven nurses now through it at a fairly low cost over the last couple of years. And one statistic I do have off the top of my head specific to the medical providers has been the waiting periods that we've reduced in the hospitals of our sexual assault victims. And at Mercy Medical Center in Roseburg in Douglas County, our average wait for a sexual assault victim showing up unannounced in the emergency room has gone down from over 2 hours to an average of 47 minutes. Again, that's on average. And that's just by having more sexual assault trained nurses, more police officers trained, and the immediate availability of victim advocacy services all working together. Last thing I wanted to mention was, and I mentioned bringing those groups together, familiarity, bringing cooperation with regards to not only the case review, but the actual execution of the investigative resources in the first 48 to 72 hours of a case, which is the acute type of sexual assaults that we are specifically trying to address in our emergency rooms. So that's kind of a success story from a rural SART in southern Oregon. It's even when it wasn't mandated, those were, the enumerations on this bill are exactly how my SART is set up, and most of those in Southern Oregon, like I said, it was relatively easy to do and follow, and it was very inexpensive. So if there's not any questions, that's kind of my success story from Douglas County.
All right, Patrick, if you'll stay there, we'll take Elizabeth's
sure.
testimony, then I'm going to open up for questions at that time.
Chair Przanski and Vice Chair Cruz and members of the committee, my name is Liz Jacobson. J-A-C-O-B-S-E-N. I am an advocate and the crisis response coordinator at the Sexual Assault Resource Center. So I am an advocate for survivors of sexual assault in Washington County, which is a suburban and rural area. And I, in support of Senate Bill 557, I'm here to talk about a success story in our county. In my role as an advocate, I would not be able to provide the service as effectively without our Washington County CERT. Advocates are essential to the survivor's overall experience with the criminal justice system. And a survivor's satisfaction with the process is ultimately tied to his or her connection with an advocate, because as advocates we navigate the entire process along with a survivor and provide an access point to every point of the system. We facilitate interactions with every other member of the team. We cannot operate in isolation, and if we did not have solid working relationships with each of our professional partners, we would not be able to serve our purpose. Without collaboration between advocates and other responders in our county, survivors often feel unsupported and frustrated and drop out of the system altogether. However, as a member of the Washington County CERT, I have personal connections with sexual assault nurse examiners, the head of community corrections, a counselor at a local campus, advocates and prosecutors at the district attorney's office, and detectives at each of our county's law enforcement agencies. No matter where a survivor is reporting or what questions they have, I know who to call, and I don't have to waste time waiting through phone trees or answering machines to get in touch with a person who I know is going to not only know who I am, but also is going to want to help. Furthermore, I know that the person that I contact, we're going to share a common language, and they are already going to understand my role as an advocate. I trust that every CERT member and I share at least one common goal, which is to treat a victim with dignity, but I also know that our roles are different, and a deeper understanding of those differences leads to a more seamless response. We know what the barriers are going to be ahead of time, which allows us to strategize solutions for communications and work together as allies. For example, during a law enforcement interview, my role as an advocate differs widely from the role of the detective. I'm there to support the victim's choices and make sure that that's informing our response, whereas a law enforcement officer is there to assess and record a story in a chronological order, and those things can be at odds. But when I am in a room with someone who I know is part of our CERT or from an agency that participates on our CERT, we have a mutual respect for each other's roles. I know that some of the questions an officer is going to ask are difficult, but I understand the reasons behind those questions and can prepare a victim for what's going to happen next. If there are any problems that arise, I am confident and comfortable addressing those then as when we come together as a team. And so my experience with the CERT is that I really, as an advocate, would not be able to perform my job without that formation.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Now we're going to take questions. If anyone has questions, Senator Cruz first.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Patrick, with a couple of additional pieces, this kind of looks like a subset of LIPSIG. What is the connection?
Chair Przanski and Vice Chair Cruz, I wasn't sure I understood the acronym you listed there.
What does it stand for?
Wouldn't it be?
This is going to be
more like council. MDTs.
Like the MDT?
Yeah.
Outstanding correlation, Senator. The correlation between an MDT and a CERT, I think the things they do share in common are case review and consistency. The MDT being specific to child abuse, all forms of abuse from neglect on up through, of course, molestation, sexual molestation, is specific to children. The most under-investigated, under-supported, and under-prosecuted population within, abuse community has been identified as adolescents, young adults, and, of course, senior citizens. The CERT is more specific to the adult versus adult or adolescent rape, the date rape proverbial, is the old term, the dating violence we're seeing in college and high school now, and not so specific or confined to child abuse.
Mr. I guess what I was more towards the LIPSIG model of the local coordinated.
But LIPSIG, from my understanding, is basically the coordination of the different services for all of the different, say, law enforcement. And that's more of a policy issue discussion. This is actually teams that actually are going to sit around, just like the MDT does, but it's focused on sexual assault.
Correct.
And the adult.
Mr. Chair, I understand that.
Okay.
But there are coordinating councils that kind of look at all the pieces and how they how they interact with each other. That was kind of what I was looking at. I mean, rather than have a separate universe kind of operating on its own, it's got to be connected to the Matrix. And I was just wondering if there was that sort of connection in this. And you may not know the answer to that, but...
No, but I think that I understand the model that you're talking about. Basically, it's the same type of thing. You're bringing the different law enforcement agencies on the LIPSIC together, and you're saying, this is all the resources we have in the state and the county to provide law enforcement services to the county, and they work together to try to make certain we get the most efficiency for all the different services that are available. It's similar in this as to having all the people coming together, but it's specifically located or focused on the investigation of sexual assaults in adults, but they are going to be coordinating together, but it's not in the sense of resources from each. It's basically making sure the detectives, the nurses, and all the others that make the components similar to MDT, but focused on the adult range.
That's correct, Senator.
All right. Let's see. First, we've got Senator Bonamici, then come back to
Senator Wissett. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you've addressed it. I serve on the Multnomah County Local Public Safety Coordinating Council, and I don't see this as duplicative. I could see somebody from a SART team serving on the LIPSIC, but it's really, the SART team looks like a much more specific issue.
But it's...
Yeah. We're talking the same thing. Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Patrick. It's my understanding that this would be essentially cost-free to the county because it's just adoption of policy. The cost to medical facilities does require employing or contracting with at least one sexual assault forensic examiner with all these different medical facilities. And it was your testimony that these people, probably existing people, could be trained.
Chair Przanski and Senator Wittsitt, you're absolutely right. Almost 100% of the sexual assault nurse examiners I have worked with were already employees of the particular medical provider and were just sent to a little bit of specialized training as we do in law enforcement. Someone starts to specialize in a particular area.
And could you quantify the cost and the availability of that training in rural areas?
That actually, Ms. Herman has that specialization more off the top of her head. I've been involved in helping providing the training, not only locally in Douglas County, but I've assisted with the regional training as a guest instructor several times. And the Sexual Assault Task Force, which of course is the nonprofit wing of the Attorney General's Office, does provide the training themselves. And they do have to hire and contract instructors, but they also have a couple on staff, so it's mitigated somewhat. I don't have the figure, however.
Could we get that thing?
What we're going to do is, after we conclude with this panel, I'm going to give a charge to Sarah to follow up with the Dash 2s. I think there's a good point that that Gretchen made regarding the applicability to these centers, Liberty House and Kids First. What I want to know is whether or not, it sounds to me, based on my reading of the amendment, we should in fact include that because they are specially trained, and it seems to me that if CARES Northwest is taken care of by the amendment, it appears that we need to make certain that we take care of those other facilities that have the same qualified individuals, and we're not going to require someone else to come in and do the protocol. So with that, is there any other questions?
Yeah. While we're looking for research, it would be interesting to know, Mr. Chair, how many counties currently have a SART or something similar.
All right.
One of my main concerns looking at this is
we have it.
Is a cookie cutter mandate when there may be some counties that have developed their own network, and I wouldn't want to be impeding upon that.
So this is what we're going to do. We're going to ask Christine and Sarah to make the rounds to the members that have raised questions. I also ask that you check with those two organizations that are a different model than what CARES Northwest does. Make certain we've got the everyone covered. If the Dash 2s does it, great. If it doesn't, we need a Dash 3, and the chair will then entertain motions to move them forward. Thank you all very much for coming forward. Was there anyone else who wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 557? Not seeing while I'm closing that public hearing on Senate Bill 557. We're going to go ahead and let me go ahead and open it up and give a summary, and we'll bring it forward. Mike, could you be so kind and just see... I'm going to go ahead and open up a hearing on Senate Bill 783.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 783 provides that businesses are primarily engaged in the sale of tobacco products and smoking instruments on December 31st of 2008 qualify as smoke shops for purposes of the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act. Declares an emergency effective on passage.
All right, thank you very much. And what I would, I think would probably be best if we start with Senator Toffler on the bill, or do you want to...
Mr. Chair, I have people in my office right now, and Senator's been gracious.
Representative Schaffler, why don't you go and get started?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Mike Schaffler. I'm State Representative, House District 48, Happy Valley, Outer Southeast Portland. I appreciate you giving me this opportunity. I fully support this underlying bill. It gives Oregonians the ability to have a smoke in public in these smoke shops, and I think raise revenue for Oregon, adults and only adults that choose to be in the area. A couple things, though. We heard a similar bill in business and labor in House. What this bill is not about is repealing the Indoor Clean Air Act. It's not about a debate of harmfulness of smoke. It's not about the 7,000 deaths from smoking. I'm sure the vast majority of which were cigarette smokers. It's not about promoting smoking for children, or ever any. It's not about stopping or ceasing or lessening the efforts of Dr. Cohn and his staff when it comes to cessation and prevention of smoking in this state. Matter of fact, I believe it will generate revenue to add to those efforts. This is about people's ability to have a cigar and these smoke shops to be allowed to help sell their products and for people to sample them in an environment that is enclosed and has its own ventilation and doesn't send any secondhand smoke out to anybody who doesn't want to be around it. The senator here is going to really go into the detail. And I have a friendly amendment. It's a dash 3, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if you got it, but I will get it to you. And it just says this. It does not sell alcoholic beverages, but may permit consumption of alcoholic beverages in a private area of the premises that is accessible only to customers who are at least 21 years of age and in which the smoking of cigars may be permitted, but the smoking of other tobacco products is prohibited. Mr. Chair, I want you to consider this. If it in any way, shape, or form slows the advance of this bill, I would not want you to put it into the bill. I'm in complete support of this bill, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to come here and testify. If you have a quick question, I'd be happy.
Let me see if there's any questions for Representative Schaffler. Mike, if you'd be so kind, I don't think we do have the dash threes. If we can get them to council.
Yes, sir.
We'll
I just got them.
See where we go from there.
And I'd like to add one more thing. My daughter, Marcella, and Dr. Cohn's daughter, Miriam, were in a little jazz band. They had the same music teacher, Mr. Hatton, who since then moved to Australia. And they used to play in a venue in North Portland. On one side of the venue, this is before the Indoor Clean Air Act, on one side you could smoke and on this side you couldn't. That's where the band played. And I was a hard no on the Indoor Clean Air Act until I made the mistake of asking my daughter what she thought I should do, and she referred to the smell of that smoke in the venue they played, their little band played at, and she's a pretty hardcore arm-twisting lobbyist, and she convinced me to vote yes. So I support the Indoor Clean Air Act for obvious reasons, but I just wanted to share that little tidbit. Dr. Cohn is doing a great job. He has a great staff. I support his efforts, but I think I'll just leave it with that.
You may not want to talk to your daughter about what she thinks about your amendment then.
Well, yeah, she kind of frowns on, Daddy has to go out on the deck in the rain if he wants to have a cigar. All right, thank you.
Mike,
thank you very much.
Can I ask a representative question before we run off?
If it's a question he needs an answer, yes. But
it is about the bill. If that's okay.
Yes.
Thank you, Representative. I'm glad that your daughter is the voice of reason.
She is.
Family. I do have a question because we voted on this last session, so I am hoping you can clarify for me what the difference is as I'm reading through this, and this is reading through the different percentages A section, which is changed now from a little A to a big A, and I know you don't have this in front of you, but we define as primarily engaged in the sale of tobacco products and smoking instruments with at least 75% of the gross revenues of the business resulting from the sales. And then we are adding on sub E, or was primarily engaged in the sale of tobacco products and smoking instruments with more than 50% of the gross revenues of the business. It looks like we're grandfathering in businesses from 2008. Can you explain why we have 75% in the sub A and 50% in sub E?
No.
All right.
We'll see if we can get that answer.
Okay. Thank you for the question, though. I'll get back to you on that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. We'll get answers on this. All right. Short and sweet. Senator, you're next. Welcome to judiciary. We try to make everyone stay, you know, very comfortable.
Oh, well, thank you. Chair Prozonsky and members of the committee. I'm Chris Telfer from District 27, which is in sunny Central Oregon. And I will say this has got to be the most popular committee. The hall is packed out there, and it's still people are on their first cup of coffee. So I'm rather impressed. I don't know what you do here, but you certainly have attracted. You've certainly attracted a lot of people. Senate Bill 783 does basically two things. And with these two changes to the current law, Senate Bill 783 will create some jobs by rehiring a number of people. And I believe there are at least 50 cigar shops throughout the state that will be affected by this, which would allow them to rehire personnel because their sales have been down because of the current statute. We will actually increase in adherence to the Clean Air Act through 783. So let me just explain what current law is and what this bill is doing. Current law basically says that a cigar bar where they have a full on-premise liquor license, they can, in fact, operate within a mall, within another building complex, as long as they have separate ventilation. A cigar shop, on the other hand, which is retail sales of 75% of these cigar tobacco products, has to have a separate building. So the question that has been given to me by a number of cigar shops is, why do you have to have a martini in your hand in order to smoke a cigar in a separate ventilated building? This bill would change that so that a cigar shop that does not serve alcohol, does not necessarily want to serve alcohol, can operate in a building that has separate ventilation and not have to be a separate standalone building. The other thing that it does, and I believe the Fire Marshal's office is here to speak to this, is currently, under current statute, which was passed in 2007, the bill, the statute says that in these self-contained ventilation systems, they have to be certified by the Fire Marshal. They have to hold a certification from the Fire Marshal. Frankly, there is no such thing. And the Fire Marshal will attest to that, or testify to that. So, frankly, you've got all these cigar bars out there that are currently operating illegally because none of them have the certification. So, I think what this bill does is assists in the definition of the adherence to the Indoor Clean Air Act and makes it more equal as far as cigar shops and cigar bars being able to use separately ventilated establishments in order to operate. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, here we go. Any questions for Senator
Telfer? I do have one.
All right,
thank you.
That's Senator Dinkfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, and I'm probably on my second cup of coffee already, Senator
Telfer. You're ahead of me.
Thank you. I do, and I missed if you were... Are you the dash twos?
Dash two is what we are.
And I noticed that you did take out that difference between the revenue discrepancy in the original bill. I'm curious about that, and also the fact that I noticed, as I mentioned to the good representative, there was a grandfather clause in the original bill. And so in your amendment, that's taken out.
Chair Prozonsky, Senator Dingfelder, that's correct. The original bill had too many ideas in it, and actually what we decided to do was just simplify this. And we want to maintain the fact that these cigar shops are predominantly cigar shops. They're retail operations. They sell cigars But sometimes people want to come in and do one of two things. They want to try a cigar, and so they will smoke it in that operation. Or they just don't want to be smoking at home, in their own homes or whatever, and so they come down there. Most of the cigar shops around are very small in as far as seating. So unlike a cigar bar where you have maybe hundreds of people smoking, a cigar shop is a very small handful of people at any given time.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions? All right. Just one other piece of clarification. Senator Teflon and I spoke about the original bill. When we reviewed it together, there were some, as she said, multiple facets to it. What this amendment, the Dash 2s, would do, and this is what I stated I felt comfortable moving forward, was in fact going to open up the option for the regarding buildings that are not standalones that have separate ventilation systems. In her research, she did in fact find out from the State Fire Marshal's office, and we do have someone that will be testifying as to a program that we think is in existence that apparently is not. So everything else that's in the original bill will be, let's say, removed, and it would just move basically on the Dash 2s if we are going to go forward. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
You bet. All right, so what we're going to do is I've got two other people who are in support, and I have a panel of, that are opposed, and I have one that is neutral, and that's the State Fire Marshal. So I'm going to go ahead and, let's go ahead and get Donna Dish from the State Fire Marshal's office to please come up. I'm going to ask to fill out the panel with Mark Luca and Mike Swinford, I believe.
Good morning, Chair Prozowski, members of the panel. My name is Donna Dish, and I am with the Office of State Fire Marshal. And as the Chair said, we are neutral on the bill, and that is certainly not to dilute the issues or opinions on either side, but the Fire Marshal would like to be removed from the Indoor Clean Air Act, basically because we don't have the scope of practice or knowledge to ventilate do as we've been requested by the Act, and that is to have a ventilation system that is certified. That's outside the scope of the State Fire Marshal, and assistance to the State Fire Marshal, whose authority and expertise is to enforce codes protecting life and property from fire, which is partially why everybody's waiting on the hallway, because there's a little sign over there that says the occupancy is 50. So we do appreciate that.
Can you change that?
Bigger room than 50.
So we do appreciate that very much. To accommodate the inconsistency that's already in the Act itself, the Oregon Health Authority and the Office of State Fire Marshal created a number of agreements abdicating the authority from the jurisdictional assistant to the State Fire Marshal, which would really be the local fire departments most of the time, to the Oregon Health Authority, who would actually certify the ventilation systems. So there's a number of agreements, and each one has to be done separately with that local authority. And so there's been quite a workaround to accommodate the way the law was written. This change would really improve and streamline rather than duplicate the standards of ventilation required by the legislation. It would eliminate or transfer functions that are inconsistent with the mission and funding sources, and it would create a more effective and efficient legislation using things that are already in place. I'm not sure that the health authority is the final person to look at the ventilation systems, but that's an option, and that's one that we've been doing lately. So, like I said, we're requesting to be removed. Thank you very much.
All right. Let me just see, since yours is so particular, is there any questions for the Fire Marshal's office?
I seem to have a lot of questions on the bill. Thank you. The supercharged coffee on this morning. I do have a question, and I certainly appreciate your testimony. What disturbs me a little bit about this is looking at the Dash 2 amendments and where you're taken out, I think it is in the Dash 2, where it says that a ventilation system is adequate. So who would determine it's adequate?
That we are asking to be removed, and we have not defined who would determine that, and we do not know the answer to that. I'm sorry.
One of the things that we will go through when council gets back, I'll make a note of this. We'll figure, I'm just surmising someone such as DEQ or somebody as an agency, I don't know who, might have that jurisdiction.
I don't know. I think it would have to be local building codes.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
But I think that would be helpful to have clarification on that before we move forward.
We will.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for coming forward. You're excused.
Thank you.
All right. Gentlemen, whoever would like to start off, if you give us your name first and then your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Przonski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Luca. I live in Staten, Oregon, and I'm appearing on behalf of Saadi Hadid, who is unable to be with us today. He's the owner of Ava Cigars and Wine here in the Lancaster Mall in Salem, and I'm here in favor specifically of the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 783, and I thank Senator Telfer and Representative Shoffler for their work on this issue. Mr. Hadid is a Syrian immigrant, an American success story, but his dream is in jeopardy because of an oversight in the Indoor Clean Air Act. When the former tobacco store space in Lancaster Mall became available, he purchased it and opened his shop in 2008. Obviously a considerable investment to open the store, but he was able to be profitable in just 2 months. Then the Indoor Clean Air Act took effect, and he had every reason to believe he would qualify because the unit that he occupies is a separate building. I did include it with my written testimony up there, a map of his facility. When the mall was built, he was actually a standalone liquor store building, is what was there before, with solid concrete walls and its own roof. The mall expanded across his space, so they only share a roof. There are no actual businesses attached other than the mall itself. And his space has separate ventilation, which, as a result, no smoke from his store is able to enter any other business. However, he was denied his exemption in November 29 during the holiday season, and he's asked for your help to help fix this law. Even though the economy had already been in recession for some time when the ban went into effect, until it was denied, he had 4 to 5 employees working approximately 170 hours a week and a devoted customer base. In addition, he had in-store promotional events, and with that, he was able to be profitable 12 out of every 14 months that he was open until the ban went into effect, at which time Ava has only been profitable 2 out of 14 months. So when the original law was passed, it's my understanding that the intent was that the smoke would not enter any other establishments. Ava's been interpreted to be an attached business, but he has a separate ventilation system that's documented by 4 contractors, and I've included their written statements with as an exhibit that prevents the smoke from leaving his store except through the rooftop ventilation system. His store has a 3,600 cubic feet per minute ventilation removal system in a 4,000 square foot space, so it's adequate to remove the smoke about once every minute from his store. Just for those that may not be familiar with ventilation standards, a fiberglass plant is required to remove the air every 8.5 times per hour. He's doing it 50 something times per hour, so he's way above the standard for even a more dangerous environment. So the Dash 2 amendments would help him by allowing him to prove that his ventilation system is adequate to remove this smoke. It does filter the smoke prior to it leaving, so as I said, it's more than adequate. The damage to Mr. Hadid's store sales, though, are because one major reason his customers buy from him instead of online retailers is that Ava's staff has a great deal of experience in helping customers select the right product, which customers used to be able to sample in store. When a customer samples a product, there's an implied obligation to buy, which drives local sales. We call that the Costco effect. If you've ever been there on a Sunday and bought sausages you didn't think you were going to buy. But because they cannot sample the product or simply enjoy their cigars in the company of people of similar interest, customers have shifted their buying habits to large corporate online retailers and have the cigars shipped to their homes, and this has several negative effects. First, this local small business has lost considerable sales to the large corporate retailers.
I see that you're basically reading the testimony. We have the testimony, so if you wanted to summarize, we have another couple of bills that we need to get public testimony on today.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. Some of the key points are that the state of Oregon has also lost $20,000 to $30,000 in revenue from Mr. Hadid's shop. The customers are still smoking. They're smoking at home, and this exposes more people to secondhand smoke because they're smoking around their families and children, as opposed to smoking only around other smokers in a ventilated environment. I would join Mr. Hadid and his family and employees and ask you to pass the Dash 2 amendments and Senate Bill 783 to the floor, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
All right, well, thank you. Mike, if you'll give us your name and testimony, please. Sure.
Chairman Przonski, members of the committee, my name is Mike Swinford. I'm a public school teacher by trade. I hold a bachelor's and a master's degree from Western Oregon University and have been a licensed teacher since 2005. The first couple years after receiving my state license, I was able to sub 4 to 5 days a week and support my family, my wife, and my two kids. Once the economy hit a downturn, I am now, last year, averaged 1 day a week and had to get a part-time job. I am a part-time employee currently at Ava Cigar and Wine. This year, for subbing, I have yet to be called once. So I'm very grateful to be able to have this opportunity to work and provide at least some monetary income for my family. To make it brief and not read my testimony, basically I've seen the store suffer financially. As was stated, we went from about 170 hours a week of labor. We're down to about 70 currently. My hours have been cut from 30 to 20 as a part-time job. I just support this for not only Oregon State revenue, but to clarify the original intent of the Indoor Clean Air Act, which I also support. So other than that, you have my written testimony, and I thank you for your attention and willingness and ask that you pass it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you very much. I'll answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Questions for either gentleman? Thank you all very much for coming forward and giving your testimony today.
Thank you, Senators.
Our last panel I have scheduled at this point is Mel Cohn, Colleen Herman Franzen, and Stephanie, I believe it's Tama Sweet. If you all would please come forward. Dr. Cohn, if you'd like to start off, we'll let you do so. And if you do have written testimony, as I've asked the others, please don't read it into the record. We have it as part of the record, and just give us your points that you would like to emphasize.
Thank you. Senator Przonski, members of the committee, good morning. I'm here to talk with you about my concerns about this bill, and they are laid out in detail in my testimony. I will just cover the high points. With all due respect to Representative Schaffler, and let me tell you...
Mel, I need you to put your name on the record.
I'm sorry. Chair Przonski, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the director of the Public Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority and the State Health Officer. So with all due respect to Representative Schaffler and our daughters, and by the way, I would like to put in the record that when these girls come of age, you all better watch out. They are a force to be reckoned with, both of them.
Can't wait.
In a very real way, this bill is about the dangers of tobacco use. Tobacco continues to be the leading preventable cause of death and disability, and I'm very concerned that this bill, even with the amendments, has the potential to weaken a major step forward that we took here in Oregon with the passage of the Indoor Clean Air Act. The question about separating, about is there a ventilation system that could be used that would actually adequately remove smoke is a very, very difficult one. And in fact, the Surgeon General, the Centers for Disease Control, and the Professional Society of Heating and Air Conditioning Engineers have said that no such ventilation system exists that can completely remove exposure to this smoke. And that's sort of the scientific take on this. I would add to that We have certified, I believe, approximately 15 to 17 cigar bars in the state, and a number of those have closed. The reason they have closed, we have been told, is that there were complaints about the ventilation system. So that's a sort of common sense version of what the science tells us as well. This bill also really opens the possibility for these establishments to be to proliferate in malls. There's sort of no ceiling on how many of them there are going to be, and I think it's a step in the wrong direction for that reason. So in summary, I think this bill would result in more people, including children, potentially being exposed to secondhand smoke. There are some administrative issues for us in the program. I can tell you that the enforcement of that cigar bar provision and the certification provision in the current bill has taken an incredible amount of time, energy, and money from our tobacco program. And if this bill were to go forward, there would be quite an additional burden on our program as well that would take away from the other prevention activities that we do. So with that, I will stop. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Ladies, who would like to go next?
Sure. Thank you. Chair Prozanski and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Colleen Herman-Franzen, and I'm the Advocacy and Outreach Manager with the American Lung Association in Oregon. The Lung Association is here today in opposition to Senate Bill 783 and its related amendments. You have my testimony in front of you, so I'll just hit the highlights today. The Lung Association opposes Senate Bill 783 because this bill would make substantial changes that would weaken the Indoor Clean Air Act and also increase people's exposure to secondhand smoke. The Indoor Clean Air Act, as you've heard, has been a great success. A 2009 study found that 100% of observed bars across the state were in compliance with the new law in their indoor areas. At the time of its passage, two narrow exemptions to the law were written in to protect existing businesses. Senate Bill 783, including the Dash 1 amendment, would greatly expand the smoke shop exemption by eliminating restrictions on where and how smoke shops may operate. We are here today because we are greatly concerned about the removal of the standalone exemption to smoke shops. Removing this requirement would allow smoking lounges to operate inside malls or other settings with shared walls and ventilation. This would expose employees, the public, and children to the dangers of secondhand smoke. We know that most Oregonians support smoke-free places. 9 in 10 Oregonians agree that people should be protected from secondhand smoke. Finally, local business owners have been sharing their concerns about Senate Bill 783. Two of those business owners are Christy Young, the owner of Madras Bowl in Madras, and Lori Pearl, owner of Tigard Bowl in Tigard. Unfortunately, they couldn't be here today, but I'd like to summarize their thoughts. Smoke-filled bowling alleys used to be the norm in our community, but thanks to the Indoor Clean Air Act, all bowling alleys are now smoke-free. Madras and Tigard Bowl are family establishments, and they are really concerned about the possibility of children and young adults being exposed to more smoke shops throughout Oregon. Tigard Bowl happens to be located very close to a hookah lounge, about 100 feet away. Lori, the owner, is greatly concerned about being able to smell the smoke from the hookah lounge in the summer when customers go outside to smoke. This happens whenever Lori opens her business's front door. As she said, if we are smelling the smoke, we are being exposed to it. If drifting smoke is being reported as a problem by a business 100 feet away from a smoking lounge, imagine how much worse the exposure would be if the businesses were adjacent to each other. So for those reasons, the Lung Association is here today to ask you to please oppose Senate Bill 783 to protect the public from the hazards of secondhand smoke. Thank you, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you have.
All right, thank you.
Chair Prozanski and members of the committee, my name is Stephanie Thomas-Sweet, and I'm the Director of Government Relations with the American Heart Association, and I'm submitting testimony on behalf of the Heart Association as well as TOFCO Partners, which is the Tobacco-Free Coalition of Oregon, and you see our executive committee members' logos on the testimony I submitted. So we're here to oppose Senate Bill 783 and the amendments the bottom line is we just see this as fundamentally weakening the Clean Indoor Air Act, and obviously very concerned about that. So just I know that you've heard some of the highlights, but tobacco still remains the number one killer of Oregonians. Every year, tobacco kills about 7,000 Oregonians, and secondhand smoke causes an additional 800 deaths in Oregon. And using current smoking rates, 74,000 kids now under 18 and alive in Oregon will ultimately die prematurely from smoking. So there was a real clear reason why we passed the Clean Indoor Air Act, obviously protecting Oregonians from secondhand smoke. There was a particular concern about employees with the passage of the Clean Indoor Air Act, and so making sure that we're protecting the health of employees who are working in businesses in this state is very important, and this bill would significantly weaken that, and we're concerned about the health quality that they would be exposed to. As you see in my written testimony, an indoor air quality study rated hookah lounges, which are currently operating under the smoke lounge portion of the bill, as unhealthy at best and hazardous at worst in some of the air quality index. And there are hookah lounges currently opening under the Clean Indoor Air Smoke Shop exemption, which we could be concerned that if this bill and amendments pass, that those would proliferate across the state even more than they are now. And we're very concerned about that. So the last statement I just want to make, and that Mel touched on, but it would be costly to implement this bill and enforce it across the state, and every dollar that's spent on enforcing the law and checking in with cigar shops, smoke shops, is a dollar that's taken away from the intent of the tobacco prevention and education program, which is tobacco cessation and keeping people off away from tobacco. So we're really concerned about the use of those dollars and making sure that they're protecting the health of Oregonians. Thank you very much for your time, and we urge your opposition to this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? First, we're going to Senator Cruz, then Senator Wissett, and then Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Could you give me the medical evidence that proves that 800 people were killed by secondhand smoke?
Chair Przanski and Senator Cruz, I might pass that along to you, but we do have that information, and we can certainly follow it up with you. I have that from our tobacco report.
Okay, I'm looking for the real evidence, not anecdotal stuff.
Well, this is going to be offline. It seems to me this is something that you should make an appointment with Senator Cruz and go in greater detail, get him the reports that you have, and then y'all can have that discussion. Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Cohen, in your written testimony, you said no ventilation system exists that can provide protection from secondhand smoke where smoking is allowed indoors. In your oral testimony, I believe you used the term completely removed. I'm wondering if you could flesh that out a little bit. Are you talking in removal in parts per thousand or parts per million or parts per billion or parts per trillion? I mean, ventilation systems are really pretty good. So when you say that it can't be completely, what do you mean by completely, sir?
Chair Przanski, Senator Wittsitt, perhaps I misspoke to use that word completely. I was speaking about what I thought was the spirit of the ventilation provision to remove this the exposure to this hazard from the air altogether. That gets to this question of that word adequate that's in the original bill, which isn't a scientific standard exactly. It's a difficult one to implement.
Really follow up, please.
Senator,
thank you. I you didn't really address the answer to the question. Is there a numeric standard there, or is it just something that you believe may or may not be adequate?
Chair Przanski, Senator Wittsitt, the Association of Heating and Air Conditioning, ASHRAE, I'm going to get their American Society of Heating, Refrigerating, and Air Conditioning Engineers, that I was basing my comments on their statement here that says no other engineering approaches, it's in my testimony, including current and advanced dilution ventilation or air cleaning technologies, have been demonstrated or should be relied upon to control health risks from environmental tobacco smoke exposure in places where smoking occurs.
Thank you.
All right.
Any, Ms. Interwell, Meacha, you were next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Cohn, I wanted to ask you about the, I think you suggested that if this bill passed, you need to spend more resources. Is that because of, I understand it's because of the removal of the certification by the fire marshal, but it doesn't sound like the fire marshal is doing that now. So I'm a little confused about how we're, even without the bill, how are we going to address the issue of certifying the existing locations?
Chair Prozanski, Senator Bonamici, the fire marshal has actually delegated that authority to us, and again, it's a very difficult one for us to implement. We have come up with a way to do that, in it's laid out in our rules that we think meets the intent of the legislature when they pass that particular part of the bill. The reason I said that this will take additional resources is that I believe our estimate is probably we would get at least 50 new applications, new establishments that we would have to certify. Virtually every single one of these is very, very time consuming. There's often a lot of legal consultation. We actually had a fair amount of litigation already that's very, very costly to us, and it takes a lot of staff time as well as dollars. Be happy to quantify that for you if you'd like. I can't do it off the top of my head right now, but it is substantial, and those are dollars and staff time that would otherwise be spent on our prevention activities.
Can you follow up? And the certification, is that a one-time thing, once certified, always certified, or is there a requirement that the business be recertified after a certain period of time?
Chair Prozanski, Senator Bonamici, the cigar bar certification, I believe, is a one-time certification, and the smoke shop one, I believe, has to be submitted annually.
All right. Thank you all very much for coming forward. And on this one, I did not have anyone else signed up to give testimony on 783. Was there someone else who wanted to give testimony on 783? Not seeing any. We'll close that public hearing. And we're going to open up our last public hearing I have scheduled is Senate Bill 734.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 734 prohibits a state from indemnifying persons in exempt service, unclassified service, or management service positions for costs of counsel and other costs of defense when judgment is entered against the person based on determination that the person has engaged in a civil rights violation or other wrongful employment practice. There's an emergency is effective on passage.
All right. This is a bill that was introduced by Senator Winters. I don't have her down on here or anyone from her staff. I do have Jen Coney with DAS Risk Management. Would you please come forward?
Good morning. Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jen Coney. I am the manager of the Risk Management Program for the State of Oregon. I've prepared written testimony, which you're receiving now, and so I'll just briefly summarize the high points. This bill, as written, requires an employee in specific service to pay for costs of defense if a judgment is entered against them. Excuse me. If a judgment is entered against them, even if they are in within their scope, course and scope of their employment. Currently, on the outset of litigation, the Department of Justice does an analysis and makes a determination as to whether or not that individual is acting within the course and scope. And if so, then the state fully defends and indemnifies them. So as written, this bill could have significant financial exposure to employees in these specified positions if it is determined that the case has no merit and should proceed to trial. Generally speaking, the cases that do proceed to trial are normally claims that have been analyzed as having no merit. The personal financial exposure to an employee could be a significant part of the litigation strategy if this bill passes as written. Just to give an idea of an average cost over the past 5 years for employment cases that have gone to trial, that amounts averages about $225,000. Other potential impacts of this bill is it may cause supervisors to avoid taking any kind of disciplinary action against employees for fear of potential litigation, and it also may impact hiring and retention of these particular employees. Further, named employees may be compelled to hire their own legal counsel to protect their personal financial interests, which could potentially create a contentious relationship between the interest of the state, in which Department of Justice would be involved, and the interest of the individual, in which private counsel would be involved. Those are the high points of my testimony. I appreciate the opportunity coming before you this morning and would be happy to answer any questions.
All right, questions. Senator Whitson, then I'm going to come back and have another
question. Thank you. Trying to formulate a question here. If the Department of Justice has determined that at the onset of litigation there is a coverage because of the name of the individual, you're saying basically that right now it's the Department of Justice who decides whether the employee was working within the scope of the practice, but really it's the judge or the jury that does, because at the end of the day, if they're within the scope, they're not guilty. Aren't you saying? I'm not sure what you're getting at here. The judge and the jury already make that decision. It's not the Department of Justice. It's the Department of Justice that decides whether they're going to incur the cost of defense. But if they're wrong, it's the judge or the jury that decides. Isn't that right?
Chair Przewodski, Senator Whitsitt, at the onset, there's an analysis that's done by the Department of Justice to determine whether or not an individual is acting within the course and scope. Let me give you an example. Over the past few years, there was a suit that went to trial in which a superintendent was accused of reverse discrimination and retaliation by some correctional officers. The analysis was done. It was determined that superintendent was acting within course and scope of his employment, and that the suit had no merit. And so we went forward to trial. And the jury came back saying that no discrimination had occurred, but there was retaliation. And the state, again, went to trial because we believed that there were no merits to the lawsuit, and that, indeed, that correctional officer was acting within the course and scope of his employment.
But then, if I understood your testimony, the judge or judge and or jury decided differently.
Chair Przewodski, Senator Whitsitt, the judge and jury did not determine whether or not, in my understanding, is that the judge and jury did not determine whether or not they were acting within the course and scope. They determined whether or not an illegal employment action occurred, in which they came back and said discrimination did.
One follow-up: the retaliation would not be within the scope of their employment. Obviously, it's illegal.
Chair Przewodski, Senator Whitsitt, it was the jury's determination that did occur.
Okay. The one question I had for you is that if it's determined through a legal process that the person did in fact act either outside of the scope of their employment and or willful and wanton behavior, isn't the rule that the cost of the representation can be passed on to the individual because they are in fact outside of their employment, or they did something intentional that I guess would take them outside of their employment?
Chair Przewodski, that's correct. That's the determination that's made at the beginning before whether or not it's made to determine whether or not Department of Justice will defend and indemnify. And if it is determined that they're acting outside of their course and scope, Department of Justice backs out.
Now, and I understand that at the front end, but at the back end or at the end of the proceeding, if a jury came back and said, we find this person has acted outside of their scope of employment, that there was, willful intent on their part, could those costs that had been incurred by the state be recovered from the individual that has been represented?
Chair Przewodski, I'm going to turn around and look at individual from my staff, Betsy Enos, who's in the audience, and ask her to come up and answer any specific questions.
We will ask the lifeline to please come forward.
Thank you.
And if you don't have the answer, that's fine. You can get back to me. The reason I know that there was a situation at a different level of government where a court actually ruled that the individuals were acting outside and was willful and wanton. I shouldn't say outside, but Wolfram and Walton, and they actually impose attorney fees against the individuals, not the government unit.
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, my name is Betsy Enos, and my title with risk management is employment claims consultant. That's kind of a glorified title for an insurance adjuster. That's basically what I am. And I apologize, this is the first time I've ever had to testify, so I'm a little nervous, so please bear with me. Your question about when the jury verdict comes in and if they came back and said that we find for discrimination against the named defendant on the lawsuit, we would pay the indemnification and the defense costs on that lawsuit.
Okay.
We don't transfer that back to that employee. And as Ms. Coney indicated, at the onset of an employment suit, Department of Justice, and actually along with the agency and risk management, look at the facts. And many times if there is a question of whether somebody was outside of course and scope of employment, specifically you'll see that a lot on sexual harassment allegations. There is an investigation done by DOJ, and that involves interviewing people in the workplace, making a determination if we feel that they were within the course and scope of their employment, and then we will proceed with going down the path of defending the case. The issue with employment cases, they're a little different than some of the other claims that we get at risk management. A lot of claims are fact-driven, like a motor vehicle accident, A, rear-ended, B. It's kind of a fact-driven.
No, that's fine.
Employment isn't. So.
Yeah, I appreciate the clarification. Is there any questions based on what I've asked? If not, thank you. Senator Wissa.
I'm not sure that the response, as I heard it, was that you do not try to, if the person is found guilty, that you do not try to get the defense costs back. But I thought the question was if you can get the defense costs back. If it legally can, you get the defense costs back.
Not to my knowledge, can you?
You? Can.
I'm not an attorney for the state of Oregon, but in my capacity as an insurance adjuster, I'm not aware of a mechanism to do that.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 7:34. And what we're going to do now is we're going to start with our work sessions. There are some of them that may be ready and some that aren't. And I think what we're going to do is start off with my understanding. Senate Bill 71 has no amendments and that it is, in fact, ready to go forward. And with that, I'll open up the work session on Senate Bill 71.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. This is Mr. Johnston's bill, and he was not available today, so I'm covering to make the record. This was previously heard on April the 4th. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact, no amendment, no subsequent referral. This is a measure that makes recipients of the general education development certificates eligible for general polygraph licenses. That means if you got a GED, you can try to obtain a polygraph license.
Yeah, and this is just to give clarification. Currently, the statutes require someone to have graduated from high school, and since we have an equivalency through the GED, this would just put those individuals in the same position as someone who's getting a diploma from a high school. So, Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 71 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz proposes moves. How about that? Senate Bill 71 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. The chair will take a volunteer to carry this to the floor. Senator Bonamici will be the carrier on Senate Bill 71. We'll close the the work session on Senate Bill 71, and we will open up a work session on Senate Bill 405.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 405 was previously heard on March 24th. Has no revenue impact and no fiscal. There's no subsequent referral, and this is all with regard to inclusion of the Dash 1. This is the bill that allows the State Board of Higher Education to authorize a university under its control to establish its own police department and employ certified police officers. a lot of public safety employees at universities are already experienced law enforcement officers, but they're not currently required to be state certified as police officers when they're working on campus. Senate Bill 405 would permit universities to develop on-campus police agencies and employ fully certified officers with the same training and authority as other police agencies. The Dash 1 requires the university and its police department leadership to establish a process to address policing grievances.
All right. And so the Dash 1s we need to adopt, or has it already been adopted?
They haven't been adopted.
All right. The chair would entertain a motion on the Dash 1s.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 405.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 1 amendments into Senate Bill 405. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 405 as amended by the Dash 1s to the floor with the two pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 405 as amended by the Dash 1 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to just put a couple comments on the record because this is an issue I've been looking at and thinking about and working on since really the 2007 session when a similar bill was before us. I'm going to be supporting this bill. I know some of the students were concerned about it. I think this is a reasonable proposal. I know that most of the testimony came from the University of Oregon, but I think this is a proposal that applies to the entire system. I understand the concerns of the students, but I also believe that there are other universities in the region that have their own police forces, and I think that it makes sense to have trained people who are familiar with the campus. And so I understand the concerns of the students who testified, but I'm going to be supporting the bill and watching it and hope that it all works out. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Any Senator Cruz? Yes,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I heard the concerns of the students, and on this one I'm going to side with them. I personally think this is a step too far, so I will be opposing this bill.
All right. Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. My primary concern is my understanding of this bill that the fines that accrue to the police department, essentially, and I've been an opponent of that scheme in every bill that has ever come before the legislature, and I will be again today. I don't think that's appropriate.
All right.
If the fines were to accrue to the general fund of the university or whatever, but when they go directly to the department, I think it's a problem.
All right. So I'm going to put a few things on the record. First of all, the bill does apply to all universities within the university system, and it's my understanding the only university at this point is, let's say, positioned to move forward was the University of Oregon, and that's why that testimony was brought forward by them. I understand that there was supposed to have been an individual here from the university system that apparently was not able to actually stay for their testimony as to that it was applicable, and that the board would in fact look at any application from any of the other universities if and when they want to make that transition. Regarding student testimony, there is within our record today, I'm not sure if this came in earlier, but I did note that there is a student by the name of Alex Shoemaker, sophomore at the University of Oregon, who is in support of the bill, and so that is part of the record. And regarding the fines and assessments, it's my understanding that this will work exactly the same as any other police department where there are funding revenue sources or streams that go one to the unit, or I should say the unit, to the unit of the government that the department is part of, and that it does in fact go to the general fund. My understanding from the testimony we heard was that it was believed that that money or part of that money would make its way back to paying for some of the cost, maybe at the department level, but it does in fact go through the process and is not a direct feed to the university, or in this case the university police department, just like it isn't for any other, but in fact goes to the governmental unit, and then the other funding stream is handled by the court where the individual is cited to appear in front of. So that's the two streams. Any other comments? Not seeing any objections to the motion to move the bill as amended by the Dash 1s to the floor with the due pass recommendation. I have Senator Cruz and Senator Wissett opposing. Is there anyone else that's opposing? Not. So ordered.
The chair will carry Senate Bill 405 to the floor. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 405, and we're going to open up the work session on Senate Bill 412.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 412 was previously heard on March 24th. The dash amendments of interest to the committee, it's my understanding of the dash 4s and the dash 6. As to those amendments, there is no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, no subsequent referral. This is the bill that provides state law enforcement authority to tribal police officers who are certified by the Department of Public Safety Standards and whose employing tribal governments comply with certain conditions, including meeting certain insurance requirements and waiving sovereign immunity from tort liability for claims that arise from action taken as authorized under the measure. It declares an emergency effect on passage. The most significant change between the last hearing date and the current date is that an underlying case that provided momentum for the inception of this measure, the Kurtz case, which was previously discussed, has been decided in favor of the trial court. The Supreme Court overturned the appellate court's decision, and that has affected some of the parties' stances. So I believe there are folks in the room who can better summarize that case and might wish to make a record today.
Right, and I am going to ask to make that record because I think it's important, because the case that we had brought before us as to why one of the reasons for Senate Bill 412 to come forward was the Kurtz decision. The Oregon Supreme Court did in fact issue an opinion on March 25th. And what I want to do is I'm going to ask Pete Shepherd if he'd be so kind. I know that he has met with me and has given me an overview of this, and I'm going to, with a summary, ask him to put onto the record. And I believe all of us should have received the summary from Mr. Shepherd. And so, Pete, if you'd be so kind, give us your name and then walk us through your interpretation of what the Supreme Court did.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepherd. I'm here on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of the Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw Indians. Your staff has another copy of the same handout that probably Ms. Ross has distributed to you. And then also, because I never feel good about making an appearance without a chart, I did a chart for you. So, and actually, when you receive that chart, that's probably the easiest way to summarize the case. First, you know, State versus Kurtz was pending at the time of the hearing. The day after the hearing, the Supreme Court announced its opinion. The case, as you recall from the testimony previously, involved a criminal conviction of Mr. Kurtz for two crimes, eluding a police officer and resisting arrest, eluding a peace officer and resisting arrest. And as you probably also remember, the circumstances of that case involved a Warm Springs tribal police officer who had not yet attended DPSST, who engaged in a stop that occurred ultimately outside of the boundaries of the reservation in Jefferson County. In the trial court, Mr. Kurtz was convicted. In the intermediate appellate court, his convictions were overturned, and that was the status as of the hearing. The Supreme Court reversed the Court of Appeals determination. I thought perhaps the easiest way to summarize its significance for Senate Bill 412 is to use the chart and first focus on what we know was decided in Kurtz. And what we are certain was decided in the Kurtz opinion is that as to tribal officers' authority to act as a peace officer or a police officer for purposes of enforcing any statute defining an offense in which the tribal officer is the victim, so eluding or resisting arrest were in those categories. Those two categories used specific definitions of peace officer and police officer. And what was unique about those definitions in the Kurtz opinion was that they're both open-ended definitions. One of them was framed in terms of the expression includes and then followed a list of officers, and the other one was means, and then that list of officers included an open-ended invitation to look at other statutes, which said, and any other statute defining a police or peace officer. And so what the court decided for sure is that as to any offense in which those two specific definitions at issue in Kurtz, that turns on those two specific definitions, and specifically in which an officer is a victim, and for those two specific statutes at issue in Kurtz, we know for sure now that tribal police officers do have the authority to make the arrest that Officer DeVino did and to engage in the enforcement action that Officer DeVino engaged in. We also know for sure from the Kurtz opinion that we do not yet have in place in Oregon any answer to the incidental questions that we talked about at the hearing about regulatory oversight of tribal police departments or the tort remedies that a person who is subjected to a police action that we now know, even one that we now know is authorized by Kurtz. We know that Kurtz didn't decide that because it just wasn't, the only issue was the interpretation of those definitions. We also believe that there are closed definition statutes which were not decided by Kurtz, as to which in turn are the keys to determining whether a tribal officer under Kurtz has authority to take enforcement action. Let me give you two that were not decided in Kurtz. The first is the set of statutes in Chapter 133, which are statutes that define the authority of police officers to make arrests on probable cause, or more generally, without having an arrest warrant. And the other area is Chapter 133. Those are statutes governing the statutory search and seizure provisions that apply to the powers and duties of police officers executing search warrants and obtaining search warrants. Both of those chapters, the powers of the officers involved in those chapters, depend on the definitions in 133.005 and 133.525. And as to those definitions, those are closed definitions. They simply say the terms the officers involved mean, and then there is no open-ended definition like the ones that were at issue in Kurtz. So I think it's accurate to say that Kurtz did not decide the question of a police officer's power under those closed definitions. I think also in the chart, and so that category of the public safety benefits that flow from giving tribal police officers the power to enforce certain statutes, we know for sure that, in my view, that Kurtz didn't achieve those benefits as to the chapters which turn on a closed definition of police officer. There's less certainty about a whole category of cases that are depicted in my chart with the polka dot region, the red and green categories. We can expect, I think it's accurate to say, that there will, in the wake of Kurtz, there will be litigation in our trial courts and probably in the appellate courts as well, in which criminal defendants who are charged with crimes that weren't specifically described in the Kurtz decision will be arguing that Kurtz didn't decide the question of the tribal police officer's authority as to that particular crime. Those would be the red dot, the little red dot cases there. And the prosecutor, of course, in each of those cases is going to argue that Kurtz did decide those questions. And I think some of those cases, we don't know what those boundaries look like yet, but there's certainly going to be litigation around that, those questions. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the spirit of the invitation. I'm really not here to try and be an advocate, although, of course, my client wants the bill to become law. I think I would end my description of Kurtz in that way and answer your questions. I don't want the opportunity to pass, though, to observe for the committee that I don't know what the ultimate fate of the bill is. My client certainly hopes it becomes law, but if it does become law, I think it will be a much better law for the involvement and active involvement of the Sheriff's Association and others in the work group that we've had.
So, Pete, I just want to say I want to thank you for, one, spending the time you did with me. He's walking me through this. As most of you know, with his prior employment at the Department of Justice, there's been many years that we've worked together. I've always looked forward to having those conversations and knowing that I would get both sides of the issues from you as to the pros and the cons. And for me, getting this perspective, and one of the things that's concerning to me when I see after the Kurtz decision is that there is that potential for this additional litigation as to whether it applies to tribal police in a particular type of crime, as you said,
and also I think the issue on the torts. To me, this is the thing that I think is imperative now that we know that the courts have, in fact, gone forward and made its opinion known and saying that tribal officers do have this authority, that we clarify, codify it to make certain that everyone knows as to the full extent of that, and also put in place the best we can as the bills will go forward as to the protections for tort claims that could, in fact, be brought against one of those tribal officers and those tribes. Senator Wissa, did you have a comment?
Just a question. Are we going to hear from the Sheriff's Association?
I am going to ask them if they want to come forward, if they'd like to. And so anyone else, anything else for Peach? Thank you very much. Now, John, we have not had an opportunity to talk. I did see that you have handed in what I would consider continued opposition from the Sheriff's Association. And if you'd like to come forward, I'd be more than glad to entertain that. I will be asking specifically to respond to some of the stuff that Pete Shepherd has brought forward regarding, specifically from my perspective, why we wouldn't be working this bill to go forward to make certain we put the tort coverage in place.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Powell representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I appreciate this opportunity to talk to you. In the last day or two, the committee should have received a script from Sheriff Wolf, and I think that was sent day before yesterday to all committee members and staff. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the overriding issue with Senate Bill 412 is that it is a voluntary action on the part of the tribal governments to become a police agency under the Act. And the reason for that is state law cannot affect the tribal government. And the source of power of tribal police agencies is the tribal government. So our opposition to this is not to them adopting a tort limit. That would be a good thing. Our opposition is that all of the laws that regulate policing in the state of Oregon will not apply to these agencies. And that is the essence of our opposition to this act. They're a sovereign entity, and that's fine. We respect that. At the same time, they want all the powers of policing, but not being subject to Oregon state law that governs policing. And those are very substantial. Plans, for example, the statutes require a plan on use of force. The open records law, and like statutes, do not apply to a sovereign. And that is the essence of our opposition. We do not oppose tribal governments having insurance, for sure.
All right, questions? Senator Wissa.
Yes, thank you. I think that you didn't really mention the reciprocity issue. But I think that's a main thing. One of my major concerns with the bill, it does not include any reciprocity. I thought it was very poignant, I believe, in Mr. Wolf's testimony, or Sheriff Wolf's testimony, written testimony, when the question was asked why local law enforcement should not be given the same opportunity to assist in the interest of public safety on tribal lands. We were told that their people become concerned when they see local law enforcement on the reservation. I mean, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, I would think. And if we're going to, if they're concerned about local law enforcement on their reservation, maybe we should, you know, because of the sovereignty issue, perhaps we should be equally concerned on the opposite. As my understanding, Kurtz really fixed the in hot pursuit issue, and which was my understanding was the original intent of this law. So. Would you comment on the reciprocity, please?
Sure. Senator Przanski, Senator Witsit.
Yeah.
Yeah. My name's Bob Wolf. I'm the sheriff of Polk County. With the issue of reciprocity, that has been the standing issue with the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Kurtz, the decision by Kurtz has been good. The Sheriff's Association has spoken already about the fact that we believe that tribal officers should have the authority to engage in fresh pursuit leaving the reservation and should be protected by Oregon law against assault to that officer because they're peace officers on their land. Just because they cross a border should not restrict them from the ability to be protected. The Kurtz decision, though, does not grant Oregon peace officers the authority to enter onto the reservation without getting assistance from the tribal police. The Kurtz decision also has not addressed the issue. I know Mr. Shepard addressed applying for a warrant and search and seizure, and those are still issues out there. This doesn't give Oregon peace officers, state, county, or city officers authority to come onto the reservation and apply for a search warrant through Oregon courts. We have to go to the tribal police and get their assistance to do anything on the reservation. The regulatory oversight, that's a good thing, but I believe the tribal police have wanted to attend DPSST and meet the standards. They've wanted to be equal to Oregon peace officers, and for that regulatory oversight, we fully respect that. But the safety benefits, I don't believe, are equal because Oregon peace officers, again, state, county, and city officers, particularly on non-PL 280 lands, do not possess the same authority as tribal police. And therefore, it makes the passage of this bill would make tribal police the most powerful law enforcement agency in the state of Oregon.
All right, any other questions, any other comments? Thank you very much. Does anyone else want to have anyone else come forward? If not, the chair will entertain a motion regarding the Dash 4 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the Dash 4 amendment to Senate Bill 412.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 4 amendment into Senate Bill 412. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 6 amendments into Senate Bill 412.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 6 amendments into Senate Bill 412. Discussion? Objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 412, excuse me, as amended by the Dash 4 and Dash 6 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 412 as amended by the Dash 4s and the Dash 6 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator Cruz first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I think about 90% of this bill is good, and but there's 10% that still troubles me. As you can see, we have an incredibly large number of attempts at this thing. Time's getting short. I'm going to vote no just to send a message to the House that there's still issues to be dealt with, and I think the House Judiciary Committee will be taking a hard look at this, and so I want to send a signal.
All right, Senator Wissett.
I'll be voting no as well. The reciprocity issue is a deal breaker for me. It has to be equal and opposite. I think that the testimony that this would make essentially a super policing agency of a tribal police from a sovereign nation and without reciprocity just doesn't make any sense to me.
I understand. Any other comments or discussion? All right. I have two objections at this point. Is anyone else objecting to the bill moving forward as amended with the Dash 4s and Dash 6? Not seeing that, it does pass. The chair will be the carrier of Senate Bill 412 on the floor. We'll close the work session with Senate Bill 412. Now, we have, I think, concluded all the work sessions that are ready to go today. And so what we're going to do is, I think at this point, we're going to start carrying over. Is that right? Everyone just reset? All right, so we're not going to worry about carrying over. Now, we also need to go ahead and get set
posted, as well as Senate Bill 557. I understand from a note that I got back there was information that could come back. Because we're only 5 minutes until the closing, we're going to have just set that for a work session as well. All right. Council, is there anything else that we need to conclude today?
No, Mr. Chair.
All right. Our next meeting is Monday. I believe we're scheduled for 8:30, and I'm not getting a nod from Pam. And so we will be here on Monday at 8:30, not 8 o'clock. And with that, we're anything else? Oops. With that, we're adjourned. Thank you.